This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the podcast Be My Guest with Ina Garten. Be My Guest is intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. David Remick, Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, and more. Listen to Be My Guest with Ina Garten wherever you get your podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Do you feel like people are too easily offended these days?
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Yes.
No, I don't.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, compared to what? Like, all of human history?
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. We're talking today about free speech and threats to free speech in many forms. And that includes so-called cancel culture, what it is, and whether it even exists.
That's a great question. And the answer, in my opinion, is absolutely.
I don't know. I think the word cancel is oversaturated, and I just don't like that term.
I think most Americans don't think about this.
I hate it. Like, I hate people getting canceled, and I think there are always a couple sides, and you can always catch people on a bad day.
That being said, you kind of deserve what happens to you if you're a shitbag, so.
Now, these are questions I think a lot of people have been thinking about lately, myself included. And I was struck recently by an article in a journal called Liberties by William Derezowitz, who taught at Yale and then at Scripps College in California. The article is called Birthrights, and it talks about the author's upbringing, which was in an Orthodox Jewish community in New Jersey.
I grew up in a world that was divided as if by a thick black line down the middle of it, between us and them. Us was the Jews, them was the Goyim. And the understanding was that there was an eternal fixed enmity between the groups, that the Goyim were ineradicably other, that they were alien, that they were hostile, that we were better than them, and that it was necessary to remain always within the group and to live by the norms that the group dictated to be safe, but also just to live the life that was appropriate for you. I think this is common among people who grow up in groups that are that self-enclosed, and especially groups that are that embattled, as the Jews have felt embattled historically. I don't think groups are evil. I don't think that you can't be an individual and be a member of a group at the same time. But groups often make extraordinary, and I would say excessive, claims on their members in ways that prevent them from developing as individuals.
When William Derezowitz looks at college campuses now, he sees a kind of us versus them thinking pervading students' lives, a concern, maybe an over-concern, with identity versus individuality. And that, he says, affects the way students talk and write, and ultimately, how they go about learning. Now, Bill, you've spent a lot of your life in academia as a student, then as a graduate student, then as a professor. Was there a moment when you felt like the rules around free speech started to change? What was it like before, and what was the change?
Well, actually, that change happened after I left academia in 2008. But I did go back in 2015 to teach a course at an elite liberal arts college.
Scripps College in California.
Right, in one of the Claremont colleges. And it was clear. I mean, I think maybe being away for that many years enabled me to see the situation more clearly because it was radically different. The first thing was that the person who had brought me there, who was the head of the Writing Center, and who was very militant in the new speech codes, for lack of a better word, told me, you're not supposed to say crazy anymore. You can't say crazy anymore because it stigmatizes the mentally ill. And she had a lot of other strictures as well. And then once I met my students and started to talk to them in my office, they, without me soliciting this information, because I really still wasn't aware of what the climate was, started to tell me how afraid they were really to say anything because they didn't know if they were going to say something that you weren't supposed to say anymore. Student of mine, I think she wrote on a paper that she was surprised to learn that a fellow student who had been very close friends with her for 3 years now, she was a junior, was religious, and was not only religious, but went to church every Sunday. And my student said, why didn't I know this yet? And her friend said, because I don't feel comfortable being out as a religious person at Scripps.
You know, the university that you were at for a long time, Yale University, a long time ago, generations ago, had a young undergraduate and then graduate named William F. Buckley who came along and wrote a book called God and Man at Yale. And his argument sounds a little bit similar to what you're saying, is that there was a liberal consensus at Yale. It dominated the students. It dominated the faculty. And conservatism was impossible. It was impossible to be a conservative at Yale. This is decades and decades ago. So what's changed?
Well, it may be that some things haven't changed, or it's certainly that this is a recurring problem. In fact, I don't think I was even aware of this, but when I was at college, surveys showed that conservative students actually slightly outnumbered liberals, but both were far outnumbered by moderate students. This was early Reagan. So it goes back and forth. It's, let's say, a perennially recurring problem on college campuses. I think right now we're at an especially bad point.
And is part of it also a reaction to the politics, the national politics that we've seen after the Obama era with the ascendance of Trump?
Oh, there's no question that part of what's changed is Donald Trump. And there's no question that Donald Trump and his movement embodies evil forces in American society, mm-hmm. a recrudescence of evil forces, and that a vigorous response must be made. The question is, what is that response going to be? Is it going to be the enforcement of a progressive orthodoxy, or is it going to be what colleges are supposed to do, which is to help students think better? Not what to think, but how to think.
When you look at so-called cancel culture on social media, some argue it's effectively limiting people's free speech, but others argue it's just the opposite. It's democratization of expression. Aren't students who protest college speakers just engaging in free speech themselves?
When somebody you don't like comes and speaks on campus and you pick it outside and you protest or you organize a teach-in in opposition to their views, that's more speech. That's great. When you blockade the building and don't let people in, or when you flood the auditorium and then get up and march out or shout them down, that is speech or symbolic speech used to limit speech.
So you and others have argued that the left is making academia inhospitable to certain ideas. And at the same time, on the right, there's a movement to limit what can be taught in classrooms. I'm thinking right now about the movement to ban critical race theory and certain perspectives on American history. Are there similarities, do you see, between these two currents?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, when one side says that we need to limit what teachers can say, then the other side is going to feel greater license to do the same.
William Derezowitz is a writer based in Oregon.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.